Bien, alors nous allons mettre un terme à cette partie de cache-cache et donc entamer la fin de cette très passionnante session en écoutant, pour commencer, Aileen Sweeney de Boston College, The United States of America.
For the time being.
For the time being. Nous parler donc d'un thème que nous n'avons pas abordé frontalement jusqu'ici, qui est donc, sauf à travers la question de la philosophia naturalis, ce qui n'est pas rien, mais quand même, philosophizing about nature, voilà le thème qui vient maintenant in the 12th century. Et ensuite, nous entendrons Irene Cagliazzo, qui nous parlera des laïcs et de la philosophie au XIIIe siècle, au XIIe siècle, excusez-moi, une longue histoire. L'histoire est longue, elle est même tellement longue qu'on pourrait dire les laïcs et nous, la philosophie et nous, la nature et nous, le XIIe siècle et nous. Philosophizing about nature in the 12th century.
Alors, merci beaucoup. Il faut que je dise merci en première pour l'invitation de Alain de Libera et d'Angela Avatos. C'est un honneur très grand d'être ici à la Collège de France. Et je veux dire merci aussi pour l'accueil très chaleureux et pour toutes les choses très bien arrangées et pour cet sujet fascinant pour moi au moins. Je pense que c'est pas étudié autant les philosophes le XIIe siècle. Et je vous demande pardon sur deux points. Il y a un handout et il y a des fautes que j'ai corrigées dans une autre version et c'était emprunté sans des corrections, mais c'est pas grand-chose. Et aussi pour l'absence de citations en latin. Je voyageais et je n'avais pas pris les textes en latin avec moi. Et bon. Comme tout le monde, comme moi, je n'avais pas, j'avais pas le prêt avant de partir. Bon, pardon pour ça. Et aussi de parler en anglais, je veux bien entendre de prendre des questions en français et je peux essayer de comprendre et aussi de répondre, j'espère.
Mais c'est l'anglais de Boston.
Oui, voilà. Voilà. Oh, je suis de Texas. En
fait. Ah, bon, c'est l'anglais du Texas.
Oui, et je dis aussi, merci aussi à vous de rester ici jusqu'à la fin de ces deux journées très riches mais très longues. Okay. The famous poem in Book 3, Meter 9 of Obedius's Consolation, O Qui Perpetua, is regularly taken to be, as Winthrop Weatherby called it, quote, a brilliant distillation of the cosmology of Plato's Timaeus. It gives us, so the story goes, an autonomous and coherent, those are again Weatherby's adjectives, nature, fit to become an object of study in itself, as well as the tools to craft a human psychology and morality, reflecting this stabilizing and vivifying nature, end quote. Thus is born, the story continues, natural science and a naturalized ethics in the Christian West, or at least accounts of science and morality significantly based on resources available to reason and experience rather than revelation. I do not want to dispute this claim, but to nuance it by following out the theme not of the beauty and coherence of nature, but its underlying tensions. In the Consolation, the order and beauty of nature is created by imposing limits on a chaotic play of opposing forces. Thus, the optimism about nature, and even more about the prisoner learning to find and follow his own nature, are complicated by a kind of underlying instability. It is this tension between two ideas, first the order and thus inherent goodness of nature, making it an unerring guide toward the virtue to which we are naturally inclined, and second, nature is composed of opposing forces that would redescend into chaos were it not for the restraining hand of higher and more spiritual forces I wish to follow through the 12th century. I will begin with the account of the idea of nature in the Consolation, and I will trace it back into Chalcidius and then forward into Bernard Silvestri's Cosmographia and Alan of Lille's De Planctu, but only after, as you can see in the order of your handout, some consideration of nature and its opposing forces in Adelard of Bath and in William of Conches.
Opi Perpetua, of course, is only one in a series about the order of nature in the Consolation. It differs from the preceding ones in its description of the source of all things, in its emphasis on the return of all things to the One, calling the prisoner, too, back to his true nature, returning to his source. This need for the prisoner to find and follow the order of nature is, we all know, made clear from Book One, quote, "Nothing escapes nature's ancient ordering," end quote, "except human acts," the prisoner originally thinks. And the prisoner asks, quote, "the maker of stars to restrain the rushing waves of fortune," end quote, "and stabilize human beings as it does the earth." It is love, Meter 8 in Book 2 explains, which drives the beautiful motions of diverse things bound in a mutual trust, but without which they would fall immediately into war and mutual destruction. The poetry of the Consolation never mentions the beauty and order of nature without mentioning the forces which, left to themselves, would pull it apart. When we have finally arrived at the hymn of praise for the maker of the beauty of the universe in Meter 9, Book 3, we have to note that the perfection is effected by the binding of the opposing elements under laws which regulate the relationship of cold to hot and dry to wet, which prevent fire from flying off and the earth from weighing down out of the universe altogether. It's not really clear where fire would fly off to or earth pull itself down to, though the point is clear enough. The created world is a delicate balance of opposites which would break apart without something or someone to bring it together and balance opposing forces. So where did Boethius get this view of nature whose order and integration comes on top of an unruly matter held in check by the restraining hand of Nous or God? The easy but incomplete answer, of course, is that it is the Timaeus, filtered through Neoplatonic commentators and other classical sources. The complete answer is considerably harder, and luckily for me, beyond the scope of this paper and my expertise. But Chalcidius's commentary on the Timaeus catalogs many views of nature, not just Platonist, but Aristotelian, Pythagorean, and Stoic. Boethius's view, in these poems at least, bears some resemblance to the view Chalcidius attributes to the Pythagoreans, probably Numenius, and certain Platonists. Chalcidius, following Plato, devotes a good many lines to sorting out the difference between completely unformed matter, which has no qualities, movements, nor consequently any sources of recalcitrance, and the elements of earth, air, fire, and water with their opposing qualities. Matter is passive, quote, "offering itself without resistance for adornment, since the divine mind penetrates and informs it completely and in every quarter," end quote. The account in Genesis that the earth was invisible and formless means, Chalcidius says, that it was devoid of form and disordered in the sense that it has the aptitude to receive order from God. And though Aristotle, Chalcidius points out, says that matter is in a state of deformity, it is because it desires form and order, and that the element within it that stems from the defect of its need fades away as it recedes form. However, when Chalcidius turns to Numenius, the view of matter is not neutral or blank possibility, but fluid and noxious. Numenius posits two world souls, and here I'll give you, I forgot to say, I'll give you the quote number one, but in all the quotes I won't read every single word there, I just give you a little bit of context, so hopefully you can still follow where I am. This is quote one under Chalcidius. Let's see. "What is without purpose or produces ill effects," quote, "originates in matter, which is possessed of much intemperance, an improvident drive, and a randomly motivated determination," end quote. This is the matter Plato is describing in the Timaeus as needing to be brought back to order, and this confusion must not be part of the providential plan, but a force in resistance to it. Thus, God, on this view, adorns matter, correcting its defects, but not completely, and this is quote number two, quote, "neither destroying them to the point of the material's nature entirely perishing, nor permitting them to extend and spread everywhere, and thus," quote, "bringing order to disordered confusion, limit to moderation, and dignity to depravity," end quote. And though Plato mentions the erring cause and the necessity associated with matter to yield to the persuasion of wisdom, what doesn't quite appear completely strongly or unambivalently in the Timaeus, but seems to be a strong element in Numenius, is the attribution of evil to matter. While the Timaeus describes the cycle of transformation of fire into air and so forth, it is to point out their insubstantial but not quite malevolent character. Chalcedius does describe Plato at one point as agreeing with Pythagoras that matter is the cause of evils, but while God is the cause of good. But he is setting both over against the Stoics, for whom matter is neutral, but also possessed of the seminal reasons that makes the exemplars unnecessary. Wasink's study of Chalcedius's sources on the nature of matter argues that while Chalcedius adheres theoretically to the Aristotelian notion of matter as potentiality and of its defect being in its lack of qualities but not in its character of its own, Chalcedius is in this way compelled by the metaphysical argument that matter must lack all form to take on form, and that that which lacks form cannot have motion, character, or malevolence of its own. Chalcedius even argues that if the world is eternal, then matter cannot be resistant, but must be compliant to the shaping of providence. If it were resistant, order could only be imposed by violence, and violent rule eventually breaks down. But on Wasink's view, when Chalcedius is characterizing matter rather than directly arguing for its character or lack thereof, the dualistic notion of matter from Numenius as resistant and turbulent reasserts itself. Insofar as Chalcedius resolved this tension, it is by asserting two stages in the formation of matter. First, there is the matter of pure potentiality, utterly without form and thus motionless. But once formed into material elements, it assumed the functions of motion and rest in order to employ them at different times. This notion of waxing and waning, rising and sinking, moving in one direction and then the other, the formed elements are like bodies thrown into still water, which communicate that motion to the still water, and then the water's movement in turn propels the bodies which initiated the movement. That's his analogy for what happens. Attributing this motion of turbulence itself to pure unformed matter is a mistake, Chalcedius says, born of mistaking, quote, this foreign jolting for an agitation proper to matter. Chalcedius's ambivalence about matter, and this you can see under the third quote of Chalcedius there, however, invades even his solution, as he adds that matter, even before this body being thrown into it to destabilize it, quote, provided an unstable and tremulous foundation. When we shift to the 12th century, thinkers heavily influenced by Boethius, we find echoes of Chalcedius's view and his ambivalence on nature or matter as alternatively chaotic and unstable versus ordered and purposive. Though the details shift, the tendencies to resolve any tension in the notion of matter, of the creation of matter in stages. Abelard's Deodem et Diverso, however, plays the dominant note more strongly, and this is your first Abelard quote. Quote, the best author of created things, drawing all things to a likeness of himself as much as their nature allows, equipped soul with understanding. In just this way, nature is like its creator, purposeful, logical, and free from chaotic confusion. This soul comprehends nature itself, its causes and first principles, and also is able to discover the theory behind these things. This, of course, isn't a characterization of matter, but nature, but nonetheless, this is Adelard's main characterization. When it comes to how the things are made, Adelard opts for immediate position. The corporeal stuff of the world was, he takes it, informed by diverse qualities by the artificer, yet in order that there be movement and growth, a further outside cause was required, the world's soul. And this is your second quote under Adelard. Quote, although the bodies themselves were among themselves lighter or heavier than one another, they were not able to derive from themselves the growth and voluntary movement necessary to them, since the principles had been inert and motionless, end quote. It's kind of the opposite of Chalcedius. They're inert and they need motion. This required the additional creation of the world's soul to bring dynamism to the basic elements of the world. His only question is whether both of these stages were accomplished at once, a process he says difficult to explain by reason, or whether there was a delay between creating the elements with their basic qualities, but in a kind of stasis, and then endowing these elements with movement, taking their capability for change, which they have originally, and making it actual. The state he seems to imagine is of something like the elements matter with the characteristics of lightness or heaviness, yet frozen in a kind of stasis or lack of movement. This somewhat informed corporeal nature is changeable, susceptible of opposite qualities, extremes of greatness and smallness, he says. And the soul itself has opposing passions of desire and anger, and can use anger to correct the extremes of too great and too small, and by desire, bring them to hold a middle path. Nevertheless, desire and anger themselves can fail to moderate, quote, since, quote, harassed by the corporeal passions, that's his phrase, requiring reason to call her powers back to moderation. Adelard's story is that while the world soul is grafted onto the body to rule the elementary universe, that very incorporation constituted a loss of divinity, and this is what you have partially in quote 3 under Adelard, quote, to such an extent that thereafter these very elementary dregs, which she was supposed to protect as mistress, end quote, she comes to prefer both to herself and her creator, quote, forgetting both her beginning and her end. This, of course, sounds like an echo of Lady Philosophy's diagnosis of Boethius, that he has forgotten both his beginning and his end. The story of the macrocosm's fall and struggle to return to its intended order gives the clue to the path of the human microcosm, which can, quote, restore herself to herself and bring herself back home, end quote, with the teaching of philosophy and the liberal arts. But before philosophy introduces the arts, Philokosmia introduces her five maidens, who are billed as better than philosophy, riches, power, honor, fame, and pleasure, the very things Boethius describes as the false goods that promise but do not bring true happiness. In the motif that Alan of Lille will take so much further in the Anticlaudianus, Adelard describes each of the arts as bringing determination, control, and harmony to their unruly students and subject matters. I have a characterization of all the arts, but maybe I'll skip it and I can come back to it. There's some sense of restraining and ways in which they restrain a certain kind of thing and create order. Though using the motif of Marcianus Capella's Marriage of Philology and Mercury depicting the arts, Adelard has taken it in the same moral direction as Boethius's Consolation. The sense that nature has its order, which it can and does refine, is mirrored in the arts, which, though not contrary to nature, are surely directive and corrective of it for human beings. In his questions on natural science, Adelard dwells less on the notion of higher causes needing to hold in check the wayward motions of what they control, and emphasizes instead the internal directedness of creatures, with an innate love of existence preserving their own essence. The elements tend toward their natural places and flee the opposite, and they find their ordered place in relationship to each other. To the different worries of the nephew interlocutor, that some motions like that of air seem violent or contrary to their nature, Adelard replies soothingly, and you have this in quote number 4, quote, exactly those things which seem least according to nature are rather most keeping the order of things and the laws of nature, end quote. And then he proceeds to explain how even the stormy movements of air and water are still acting within and according to their natures. While Adelard's nephew, who poses the questions about natural change, is always moving immediately from an observed outcome, for example, the growth of plants, directly to the cause in, quote, the wondrous effect of the divine will, end quote. And when they hit a snag, the nephew is ready to throw in the towel, referring all effects directly to God. Adelard patiently explains that he agrees that the Creator wills these things, but that there are natural explanations that have to be pursued as far as possible. There are some echoes about matter as a source of disorder and chaos when he chides the student for assuming that in death it is the soul that is destroyed and the body that continues, and this is your quote number 5, quote, O perverse reversal of things, that the body, which is of a base and mutable essence, being subject to generation and corruption, composed of discordant parts, and not existing with certainty, but in continual inconstancy, passing from this to that, and being neither this nor that, end quote. He further admonishes his student, and this is your last quote for Adelard, that, quote, whatever is against the reason of nature, although to the sight it is decorated with surface beauty, is rightly said to be both unclean and flawed in itself, end quote. We need not posit a substantive change in Adelard's physics from Deodem et Diverso to the questions, as Deodem et Diverso is a protreptic text recommending the liberal arts as a remedy for ignorance and immorality and narrating the origin of things in creation. Questions on Natural Science poses questions not about creation, but about the ordinary course of events in the world already in existence. But the juxtaposition of the two works does suggest a change in tone and topics of interest. The questions on natural science show Adelard's greater sense of confidence that nature's order is always present, and disorder is only on the surface and in our lack of understanding, rather than seething underneath. Though not completely absent, the sense that without a higher guiding hand it would fall apart is considerably muted in Adelard. So now I turn to William of Conches, Guillaume de Conches. It's the proper names that cause the most problem between the languages. William of Conches confronts the issue of the nature of matter and its proclivities several times in his career. In his early glosses on the Consolation, we see a definite emphasis first on the cosmological themes of Boethius's nature poems, rather than on the moral conclusions they draw. And second, on the absence of any inherent disorder or unruliness in nature. In his comments on Boethius's poem, Meter 5 of Book 1, which praises the order of nature, but concludes with the prisoner's mistaken view that fortune and human life lacks and needs to be, quote, steadied with the stability of law, end quote. William ignores this conclusion completely to concentrate on the cosmological theory and patterns of the seasons in which, quote, nothing escapes the ancient ordering, end quote. Besides not commenting on the moral conclusion of Oci Perpetua, that things are ordered insofar as they take their beginning and their end from the first principle, William takes the poem's opening reference to flowing matter as the opportunity to disagree with those who say that, quote, this flowing matter is the four elements in chaos, confusion, and disorder, end quote. This would be, he notes, the creation of something confused and disordered, which would be the creation of evil, since all disorder is evil. He considers and rejects as absurd the idea that God created disorder at first in order to show that qualities have to be ordered to exist. Whom would he want to show that? No angels or humans are yet created. The original chaos described is really just the natural contrariety of the motions of the elements which are so ordered and balanced by God. The elements do indeed change into one another. I think this is the first and actually only direct quote I gave you from William. Sorry about that. So this is the quote on William here that I'm going to paraphrase a bit. Actually, I think what you have maybe slightly paraphrased. I can't even remember now, but hopefully it gets the sense. Let's see. The elements do indeed change into one another, and Plato calls that an inordinatum iactationem. But William continues, God drives this order back, not as if there ever was disorder, but as the disorder that there would be if God did not dispose the elements to seek certain places. Weighing in on another controversy about the elements, whether the visible elements we now have, earth, air, fire, and water, are the true or pure elements, or whether the ones we see and experience are themselves composites of a pure but insensible elemental particles. In this early text, William asserts that the elements in the first hour of creation were in the same place and the same as they are now, relative to each other, tending towards their natural place as heavier or lighter, though all the earth was covered with water. He says that air and fire were thicker than they are now, and that the earth was without the ornament of the stars, and he says this could be the confusion that authors speak of, namely that the earth didn't appear and was not yet ornamented. But it is not a true confusion, but all part of the ordered creation. William interprets Boethius's line about the binding of the elements so that fire does not fly off and earth pulled too far down to mean, again, the counterfactual. If there were some place lower for earth to go or higher for fire, both would keep on moving and so, quote, dissolve the machine of the world. But for this, for William, is a full counterfactual, not something that requires actual effort to stave off any inherent order in things. William's glosses on Plato's Timaeus show the influence of Chalcidius more directly, especially on the issue of matter, as well as Constantine's Pantegni, and some combination of which seems to have changed his views on matter in certain ways. As has been noted by others, William now seems to endorse the view that the visible elements of fire, air, earth, and water are not the pure or real elements, but these visible versions are themselves composite, but in which, for example, in visible fire, the pure fire particles predominate. William seems to envision three stages of creation. First, the pure potentiality of matter to all forms. William argues that Hule had to lack all form and qualities because it couldn't have a form which would contain or could accept all the form of all the diverse things that exist. It had to be unformed and common material. If matter had some positive quality which gave the parts of matter some likeness to one another, they would turn into one another and then later into another, and thus would, in the phrase we heard before, dissolve the machine or the machinery of the world. As for Adelard, this for William is counterfactual. There is, as the world was actually created, no inherent stability. William does note that there is at the beginning something that Plato calls, quote, the turbulence of matter, but what this describes is the dynamic process by which the elements are able to be transformed into one another and move to their separate places. His analogy, and this one is interestingly different from Chalcidius's analogy, so think of that contrast, is that it is like the process of milling, in which the pounding and agitation of the grain results in the heavier pieces, the fruit, being carried downward, and the lighter pieces, the hulls, to the top. This is, as I mentioned, a different metaphor than Chalcidius's metaphor of a body being thrown into still water. For William, the turbulence has the function of bringing things into order, like separating the wheat from the chaff, not turbulence and order descending on what was stillness, as it is for Chalcidius. William of Conches' Dragmaticon, composed later than both his glosses on Boethius and Plato, is still concerned with these same questions. William retains the same view of the elements he expresses in the glosses on Plato, in which the elements are not the pure ones, the ones we see, but composed of particles. When the Duke accuses him of Epicurean atomism, he explains that these particles were not just chaotically moving around in a void without a creator, but that the particles were created together and mixed in one large body, which might be called chaos or confusion, and that in this mode, the hot and the cold clashed with each other without proportion or balance. And in this point, he quotes Ovid's line that, quote, the cold elements struggled with the hot, the wet with the dry. But from this large mixed body, he continues, the creator created four bodies, those of the elements. And when the Duke asks why God created this early stage of everything mixed together in this kind of confusion, William replies that the creator worked in the mode of nature and craftsman, both of whom begin with something rough and confused and then gradually form and order it. He adds, or, quote, as others say, God created a mixed thing to show how much confusion of things was possible if his own love were not ordering them, end quote. This is, of course, the very explanation he rejects as absurd in his glosses on Plato. Nonetheless, he interprets Plato's claim that, quote, every physical object floated with an aimless movement to refer to the natural motion of the elements, two moving toward and two away from the center, and the claim that order had to be made from disordered agitation means not, quote, that the agitation actually existed, but one might have existed had he not ordered things in this way, end quote. William explains that in order to create a world accessible to touch and sight, God created fire and earth, but that these two bodies as completely opposing forces would destroy each other. Hence, the two intermediate elements, air and water, were created to balance and mediate this opposition. William is at pains to explain that the motions of the elements as based on their contrary qualities and that the way in which they limit and direct each other's motions, these motions are balanced and ordered rather than chaotic. Fire cannot go down against its natural lightness, but has no space to move further up and away from the center, so expresses its motion in the circle of the firmament, for example. William concludes that because of this balance between the elements, the world is indissoluble. William uses the elements and their qualities to explain the motion of the elements and stars, the change of seasons, the motions of the winds. He also extends this explanatory scheme to the human body. The first human being before the fall, he notes, was perfectly temperate with equal shares of the four qualities, but labor and the deprivations of food and sleep have begun to dry out his body. It is the harmony and proportion of the elements in the human body that attracts the soul to it, out of love not for its materiality, but its proportion, which the soul seeks to preserve as far as it can. Two aspects of the Boethian nature are shifting in Adelard and William of Conches. Adelard is moving toward an account of a more autonomous nature, which does not need the continued imposition of order from above. In the questions on natural science, his explanations are of a horizontal causality, which he begins to fill in with nature's as intrinsic principles of motion and change. William concentrates on God's creation of the elements and seems to hold that the elements as secondary causes. I was just checking my time to see I'm okay still. I wrote down when I need to stop, and then I will. Bring about the variety of the physical universe. He uses the elements' opposite qualities and motion to explain the change of seasons and weather. William and Adelard both underplay any sense of impending disorder, lurking belief beneath the apparent balance of opposing qualities, except as an earlier, more or less completely overcome stage of creation. When we turn to Bernard Silvestri's Cosmographia, it initially looks like Chalcidius, or rather Numenius, has returned. Bernard's text opens, and this is your first text under Bernard, with a depiction of Silva as, quote, intractable, formless chaos, a hostile coalescence, a motley appearance of being, a mass discordant with itself, longs in her turbulence for a tempering power, in her crudity for form, in her rankness for cultivation, yearning to emerge from her ancient confusion. She demands the shaping influence of number and the bonds of harmony. Bernard distinguishes, following Chalcidius, between a primary kind of matter and matter quasi-formed into the four elements. But for Bernard, even the most primitive matter is not utterly without qualities, but is a seething mass of diverse and transient qualities. Nature demands that noise apply her hand to divide, refine, and order this warring mass by giving motion to the inert and governing random motion. Hule, or Silva, Bernard says, is both suspended between good and evil and somehow dominated by evil. What Bernard seems to imagine is a kind of ungoverned fertility that provides only ephemeral abundance and destroys immediately whatever it manages to achieve. Noise, with nature's help, makes it her first task to create amity and regularity among the elements, and taking the oppositions in matter and shape them into a balance. The elements, then, are transformed into a canvas that can accept and hold form, and then noise turns to the creation of entelechia, or soul, which is brought into marriage with matter by the power of noise, and who overcomes their, quote, normal hostility to create mutual affection and trust that Bernard tells us, quote, may be seen to this day. By the end of chapter two, and this is quote two of Bernard, the totality of created life unfolds in ordered progression from the nurturing wound of Silva, and a world of determination and plenty is laid out in the next chapters. Silva is reborn, her roughness now smooth, and her resistance turned into docility. And here I'm just summarizing what happens in the wrongly numbered quotes 5 and 6, which are really 3 and 4. As Urania, nature must travel to find Fusus so that the three can cooperate to create man. Nature can't manage, and the act of Urania is required to, quote, dispel the taint of evil from Silva and to contain fluid matter within fixed bounds, end quote. The story is more complex, and I won't go into it, and considerably darker when the task is the creation of the human being. Here, Bernard invokes more strongly matter as evil and unstable. The task is managed, but while the universe ebbs and flows, enduring forever, nourished by its very losses, man is ever liable to affliction by forces which are, quote, less harmonious, and so he exhausts his life. As remedy, it seems, Bernard doesn't say, nature bestows eyes, ears, and, quote, all capable hands on man, tools, we assume, that can be turned to self-sustaining activities, work as the palliative but not the cure for mortality. Alan of Lille, like Bernard, intones the theme of nature as constructed of recalcitrant and internally contradictory forces. But even more for Alan than for Bernard, nature is not a synthesis or true unity, but only an uneasy construction placed on disparate and volatile forces. And this is your quote one for Alan. Alan does depict nature as a guide that, quote, unites all things in a stable and harmonious bond and weds heaven to earth in a union of peace, quote, end quote. But he makes very clear that the wedding she performs is a union of opposites, that the opposites she rules pull against one another and against her rule. Alan's emphasis is on the oppositions in nature rather than on the order amongst them. In The Consolation, it is Boethius, the prisoner, who cannot fully grasp the order of nature, not nature herself, who does not have or display order. For Alan, the wonder of nature, of the unities she manages to create, is always placed against the backdrop of the opposition she has to overcome. In De Planctu, Alan writes of that things are constructed by, quote, leaguing together, federando, things hostile to one another, things whose position has carried them to opposite sides. And so he changed strife of contrariety to the peace of friendship. This marriage does bring unity to plurality and concord to discord, but it does so through conflict, quote, achieving stability by instability, boundlessness by boundary. Compared to Bernard's, Allen's view of nature is more Heraclitean. Stability is only an appearance or momentary equalization of tensions. Allen takes on the topos of human being as microcosm in De Planctu to describe the human being to be like nature, an uneasy blending of opposites. Quote, and this is your quote number two on Allen, for just as concord and discord, unity and plurality, harmony and disharmony, agreement and disagreement of the four elements unite the parts of the structure of the royal palace of the universe, so too similarity and dissimilarity, equality and inequality, like and unlike, identity and diversity of four combinations bind together the house of the human body. Similarly, in the Anticladianus, creation is presented as the joining and not the synthesis of opposites. The new human being is fashioned by a federation of discordant elements. In The New Man, Allen continues, contraries live in peace, discordants lay aside contention, but not without, quote, many a murmur. The murmuring of the flesh against spirit is a signal of their opposition, of the struggle that natural, that is, moral behavior is. The elements composing the human being are joined but not integrated, implying a moral life and a model of virtue full of tension, in which the possibility of disintegration is always near the surface, or more likely for Allen, in full flower. The unions of nature are then federations in a political sense. In keeping with this model, all the virtues and liberal arts are portrayed in terms of a task of control. I give you just one example, which is the fourth one, and here I've just taken especially all the passages where he talks about temperance as having some kind of conflict or tension or having to exert control. It's very repressive. Temperance achieves the mean by the restraint of forces within and without. Her belt, quote, moderating the drop of the tumult, summoned its undue length to rule, keeping it neither too short nor too long. Her necklace, keeping guard on the forecourt of her bosom, refused entry to any hand. Her concern is with that which should be excised from our words, circumcised in our acts, restricted and reproved in the consumption of food and drink. It's hard not to see what Allen is doing here as a critique of the more optimistic accounts of nature and naturalistic virtue. What makes Allen's vision of nature different than Boethius's or even Bernard's is not just pessimism about natural science and virtue, though there is that, but it is also the extremely unnaturalistic theology and theological virtue, apophatic theology combined with a call far above nature to apotheosis in Allen. But Allen really does feel like the end of expressing this kind of view in this kind of a way. That is both because the notion of nature changes with the domination of Aristotle's natural philosophy, shortly after Allen, such that both vice and apophaticism will have to be explained in a new language. The poet-philosopher virtually disappears from view. The kind of combination of poetry, myth, and science Brian Stock argued was present in Bernard Silvestris changes when taken over by Allen of Lille. Allen shifts the content, more pessimistic about nature's inherent balance, stability, and coherence. And in the process, he changes the form. As I'll admit, Allen's allegories are more stylized, more artificial, and ornate. It's frankly excessive. And as I argued earlier, I take this not to be a fault of Allen's poetry, but to be a self-conscious move on his part to draw attention to and problematize the form. He takes the form so far, he basically breaks it. This is, in some sense, I think, the literature which even Hugh of St. Victor's optimistic and inclusive Didascalicon mentions only as a semi-legitimate enterprise. And it is at least, perhaps, one of the senses that we haven't quite talked about yet of what it means to philosophize in the 12th century, to engage in an imaginative understanding of the world untethered to scripture or even any particular philosophical authority. But even though it looks and sounds so much different, in the next century, what remains, at least in some thinkers, is the analogy between nature as a whole and human nature, as Aristotle's notions of motion and change become the categories in which to understand human action. This is at least my view in the case of, as I've argued elsewhere, for Thomas Aquinas, for whom Aristotle's categories of natural motion become the model not only, of course, for natural law, but also for understanding habit, virtue, and vice, but also the will, both human and divine, creation, and even theological virtue and grace. Thank you very much.
Merci.